This is CliffCentral.com. Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. And welcome back, Jonathan.
Well, welcome back to you.
Well, yes, thank you. I was
gallivanting across Europe.
In the third world countries of Europe. Yes, it was fine.
Did you pee in the streets of France?
No, I don't know.
As one does?
Only when you become a citizen. Like, you have to
perform. Is that the formal citizenship?
Right.
Test.
But I already am, so no. We didn't have to do it at my time. When I was born. But yes, it's good to be back. And I noticed while I was away, there were quite a few public hearings on the expropriation, like compensation thing.
Indeed, we also expropriated your house while you were away. Sorry about that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, someone cleaned it up very nicely while I was away. So thank you, whoever did that. Well, I guess we can rope him in. Gareth Van Anselen, head of policy and governance at the Institute of Race Relations.
You almost cocked that up.
Welcome, Gareth.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a long title, so yes, you almost cocked it up. So
you didn't cock it up. It's politics and governance.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
There you go. So the IR had a submission as well to Parliament, an oral submission. The AfriForum did as well, and a few other organizations. So the interesting thing about me is the AfriForum one was the most publicized one. Andrew Ritz went on about the NDR, about all sorts of things, which I thought was an excellent presentation. He got attacked mercilessly. The IR was about property rights, and you still got attacked mercilessly by the MPs. So it appears that this thing is, well, largely just a front for as a public participation process, but really the die is cast, it appears.
I don't know what to make of this whole land expropriation thing. The thing you want to do if you want to reposition yourself as a government on something as fundamental as land reform is you need a working document. It just seems like a baseline requirement for me. As a first step principle, you put something out there. You say, listen, this is what we're proposing, and let's have a discussion about this. But this idea that you just have an open-ended sort of who knows where it's going to go, you don't know where you stand as the proposer, you don't know where everyone else in society stands, just a massive free-for-all, seems insane. I mean, I don't see how you can arrive at any mutually agreeable solution unless you give some direction to the conversation. So you have organizations like the IRR, which, you know, takes a property rights angle, and AfriForum, which tries to explain the kind of political ideology behind the ANC's positioning that's got us here, because everyone's trying to cover different bases from different angles. There's no particular thing that they can point at, and the consequence of that is everyone else who, you know, takes issue with them and fights with them is coming from some other angle. It's just an insane recipe for disagreement, fighting, a lack of cohesion or agreement.
So do you think it's planned or just I don't want to give the ANC too much credit, but sometimes the lack of a plan is the plan itself.
I can't see how this works well for anyone. I mean, it's massively damaging to the government, massively damaging to the economy, massively damaging for public debate, massively damaging for Ramaphosa, who's supposed to be the instigator and leader of this process, massively damaging for the ANC because every bit of information that comes out demonstrates how poorly they've done on land reform. Who benefits from this? I have no idea.
The communists in the ANC, the guys who've been pushing sort of National Democratic Revolution, the ones who believe that, as someone like Julius says, you have to have pain, you know, to succeed in your goals. So this is the suffering we have to go through. So all the damage is kind of worth it in the end because we'll all have land and be equal. I mean, that's the line to the public. But the reality is the guys at the top know exactly what they stand to benefit from. They don't really need an economy if they own the entire economy. You know, we need our 1 trillion rand GDP to go around amongst all of us. But if they drop the GDP to 1/10 of that, but they share all of it, that's good enough for them.
Yeah, I suppose you could make an argument that the kind of anarchists benefit from this, who, you know, disruptors and basically want to introduce some kind of state of chaos as a precursor to a revolution, you know, the EFFs of this world. But yeah, even then, because of the sort of open-ended nature of this conversation and the dire economic consequences of it, their position is sort of getting hedged in every day, because Ramaphosa and the ANC are having to come out in a sort of piecemeal way and say, actually, no, we won't take this thing and it's not going to involve this, and sort of narrowing the ambit every week, but in a kind of unofficial and ad hoc fashion, which seems to be slowly moving further away from the sort of extreme positions of the EFF.
So, I mean, just based on what you know, Gareth, and this may not be your strong point, why would ANC go out on a Tuesday evening on the interviews and say, we have taken a position to change the constitution? Because first of all, it's really early in the process. They've played their hands very early, and without really explaining why they would take such a position anyway. It's a bit strange.
It's totally baffling to make sense of from an outside perspective, and I don't know the answer, but I don't know if anyone does, but I suspect it's driven by internal politics, as all of this stuff is. There's some kind of pressure applied internally, or it's the consequence of some sort of deal, or it's the only way to appease and nullify some kind of brewing internal faction is to offer some kind of, you know, external scapegoat that people can unite around and sort of deal with whatever it is going inside the party. But it was a totally baffling, preemptive thing to say.
Obviously now we are venturing into the conspiracy theory area, because, I mean, well, anything could be true. As you say, it could be an internal political fight where certain individuals have said, look, we're going to take away leadership, or we're going to go up against you, or whatever it is, unless you do this. What about the sort of Chinese influence that's been hinted at recently, and the, you know, because the guys who are putting things on boards and then connecting them with red string have done the farms that they released on this list, you know, that AfriForum list, which does seem to be somewhat correct. There certainly are some farms that the government's interested in. Those farms are also on certain deposits of certain minerals, or they're in the areas, at least, of those minerals. And so we've just asked the Chinese for a whole bunch of money, and the Chinese love resources. I mean, is there enough there yet?
It's a logical thing for me. I mean, it's a logical argument. It may not be true or not true, but the logic is there.
Yeah, look, I think, I don't want to speculate on the problem is this, is that the announcement made about changing the constitution preempted the Chinese loan deal. But, I mean, I certainly think that the underlying analysis that underpins your points is accurate, that the Chinese have a very serious, as demonstrated in many other places throughout the world, vested interest in, you know, whether it's South African property or minerals or whatever it is, basically getting their teeth into the economy and the country. How they go about doing that, I'm not sure, but I would certainly suspect that this loan is not no strings attached, as Ramaphosa says, and there's some very serious strings attached to it.
Well, the beauty about South Africa is that, you know, the ANC is in crisis. Thankfully, the other political parties are not. No, I'm joking. Of course they are. So
we've got such a strong opposition, united in their views. They don't waver. They just, you know, they stick on path, Ramaphosa.
Enough about the EFF. But, okay, so in response, the EFF are just enjoying the chaos, as you say. The DA, I don't know, do you know what they're doing in response to this? Because it seems, A, very little, and B, they're fighting about whether BE is relevant or not, at a time when we are literally on the path to Venezuela. I mean, this is the precedent set by Venezuela and Zimbabwe, and they're fighting about empowerment in business. It's a bit strange.
Yeah, look, I mean, the DA's fundamental weakness, potentially its biggest weakness, and it's been like this with fairness to Mayamani for it precedes him by some time, is its ability to be able to talk on the economy. It's just a long-standing problem. It's never cracked. And look, it's difficult to do that as opposition. It's very difficult to dominate economic debate when you're not in power. But the party does now have, you know, provincial governments, municipal governments. It does have far more credence and significance when it talks about its policies and economics, but it just doesn't seem to care about it. It doesn't seem to authentically be something that the DA cares about. And you could extend that beyond the DA. I mean, the degree to which South Africans generally care about the economy is dire. And it's been brought home, I think, when we hit the first sort of junk status debate, it's, you know, as ever, when things start to manifest in actual things that you can understand that impact on your life, you pay more attention to them. And I think South Africa has become a bit more economic focused since then, over the last 2 years or so. And, you know, the firing of Nene, these kind of things have had a real impact. And the recession is going to have the same thing. But it remains terribly misunderstood and discussed at any meaningful level. And I think the only two journalists who discuss state finances, which for me is like the key thing, you know, there's no money. Sure. None of these parastatals are working. The country's bankrupt, going off the PIC, all that kind of stuff are Carol Patton and Hilary Joffe. You know, they're the only ones that really look at the balance sheet, government's balance sheet that comes out every month. And it's a real shortcoming in South African debate.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's the thing about maybe it's a global thing whereby the big, deep problems are hardly mentioned, and the small, stupid social interactions every day, like one of racism, dominates the headlines. But it's like, it's really, guys, we've hit the ice. What you call it? Iceberg. That's what you call it. We hit the iceberg, and now we're talking about, you know, which violin concerto we're going to play for dinner, like. What's happening here? Why is there such a lack of focus? And I'm talking about in the media generally, in the media and politics and civil society generally. There are some people who are trying their damnest to bring the most important issues to the table, but I don't know. There's just a lack of urgency about everything.
No, there's a total lack of urgency. And, you know, you can explain these kind of things when it comes to the public, because the public is always easily distracted by whatever the brightest, most sensational light was that last flashed. But very difficult to explain for a party like the DA, because, I mean, you can look at every bit of market research done going all the way back to 1994. The economy and jobs comes out as number one every single time. And it is just, why would you not relentlessly pursue this? Why would you not pour resources into it? Why would you not have a whole economics team that meets every month to discuss economics? I have no explanation.
Sorry, my last point, John.
No worries. Sorry. I might have an explanation.
I think it's about the battleground. I think the ANC pulls people into their terms of engagement. And it's always about the social racialism, this nationalism stuff. And then everyone else has to react to it. The ANC never goes for like big grand ideas, or except for destructive ones. But the opposition for somehow keeps reacting to the ANC's narrative.
Yes, that's true. The ANC has always been very good at sort of creating these giant hegemonic wedge issues, which put you in a corner as opposition, and you have to debate on their terms, and they do kind of frame you. And actually, that's true of almost all governing parties. Absolutely. They have that kind of power. The ANC is particularly good with it, and there are a whole lot of very divisive issues it can use to do that, of which race is preeminent. Nevertheless, I mean, it's not really an excuse that you need to deal with those kind of things, but you also need to be disciplined in the way you communicate and determine your own agenda. And, you know, in the 2011 elections, local government elections, for a period of about 3 months during those elections, the DA made a strategic decision not to mention the ANC. And it was rigorously enforced. And literally the rule was, you don't engage with the ANC. If they bait you, you don't talk to them. You don't mention their name. You only talk about the DA's policy and what the DA stands on stuff. And the DA did very well in that election. Look, a lot of it was because the ID had collapsed and it eats some of the support. But I think an entirely, you know, party-focused campaign made a big difference.
Yeah, so my theory on this is really that the DA has a massive identity crisis. And it's not – well, now it's to the point where it actually doesn't know what it is. But initially it was – it very much knew what it was. It was the Liberal Party in this country. It had generally liberal principles. I mean that in a sort of the proper liberal sense, not the American sense of liberal. the British sense. And it had those views, and so on economics, for example, it had quite logical, what we would consider free market views on economics. And I think those people are still very much within the DA. They certainly aren't speaking as much as they should, and they don't seem to be driving policy. And that's because on all topics, the DA, the identity crisis has deepened to the point that every time the DA used to say something that was just an obviously liberal thing to say, they would get hammered by the media or by the ANC, and generally something like race would be used. Oh, this is a white position, or this is a typical colonial position, or something like that would be used against them. And instead of saying, yeah, that was actually the position of colonialists, you're right. It's also our position, and it's been the position of governments that work and economies that work. So we're running with it because this is where we stand. And if you don't like it, don't vote for us. I mean, I'd love to hear the DA actually just say that once on one of their liberal principles. They're more than happy to say it on expropriation without compensation. Glynis Breytenbach will stand up in Parliament and berate AfriForum, and is happy to lose those voters on property rights, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But to me, it's just an identity crisis. They don't stand by who they are. And as Ramon says, and as you've reiterated, the ANC pulls them into their arena, and then we're arguing ANC policy. And the DA is arguing, leaving behind who they are, and arguing whether we could implement ANC policy better. And I think that's a massive problem. And we've said it on the show before. The DA just needs to stand by principle. And if you don't like it, okay, that's fine, but they seem to believe they've got to be this sort of inclusive tent, and this broad church and all those sort of cliches, and as a result, well, who are they?
Yeah, look, I don't like subscribing to the big man theory of politics, which we do a lot of in South Africa, and I think one of the problems with a lot of the analysis of the ANC and Ramaphosa is this idea that everything flows through him, whereas, you know, actually I think the party's in a lot more control than he is. Nevertheless, you know, big leaders in particular do play a big role in structuring and informing the way in which a party behaves, and political parties usually take on the characteristics of their leader. And I think the fundamental problem at the heart of the DA, in fact, I would say almost every single problem you can bring back to the leader. And I think Musi Maimane's character is that of a compromiser. He's actually very similar to Ramaphosa in a lot of ways. And it's all well-meaning. He wants to bring people together, consolidate people under a single banner, be reasonable, emphasize this idea that this is a non-racial party above everything else. But the problem is that he doesn't stand for anything. If you stand for everything, you stand for nothing. And one of the lessons that the DA could take from a party like the EFF is how brilliantly disciplined and focused that party is on driving issues. They identify one particular issue at any given time. If it was get rid of Zuma, they got rid of Zuma or helped get rid of him. And then it turned to expropriation without compensation, and they focus on that relentlessly. Malema is absolutely associated with that. You know exactly who he is, what he stands for, what you're getting when you vote for him. And there's a lot of unanswered questions about Maimane, and it costs you a lot in the electoral market, that kind of ambiguity.
Because in politics, it's quite good to be hated sometimes for positions. And I find the DA is so afraid of actually offending anyone that could potentially vote for them. Or they appease to people who would never vote for them in the first place. That's the weirdest thing. Like the Ashwin Willems thing. No one cares. Like literally no one cares why a sports presenter walks off the studio. But the DA, boom. 2 minutes, boom. Let's tweet. Every black person knows how it feels. No, Musi, they don't. Because they're not millionaire sports presenters.
Yeah. Look, the DA, I mean, the DA, operates and responds to the Twitter universe in a disproportional way. I mean, that universe informs the kind of decisions it takes on a daily basis.
Which certainly is insane.
Totally insane, in terms of day-to-day comms. But just to go back to your point about hate, it's not a, you never want to be hated in politics, but what all politics boils down to, every single political choice and position you push must force a voter to make a choice. It must put clear blue water between you and your alternative, and you must know that if you choose A, you are rejecting B. And the DA's problem is that when voters encounter a lot of its communication, a lot of issues, they can't identify A or B properly because the DA seems to be advocating some kind of C-like position in the middle.
Yep.
And that is how you lose votes. It's certainly not how you win potential new voters over because you can't play people off against their opposition.
Exactly as you're saying, I can tell you right now, there's blue water for me between COPE and the ANC on expropriation without compensation. It's very clear to me that COPE, Masiwa Lekota, stands completely against the entire idea. He is very pro property right, and that's what he said. Now, whether he'll never be in government, but he might get a minister post at some point, assuming there was some sort of coalition. But the point is that he's unlikely to be our leader at any point in the future. But I know where he stands, and I know where his party stands. And so, if I'm voting on that issue in the next election, very easy for me to decide. I currently have no idea where the DA stands on expropriation without compensation. I know they're loosely against it because they have said that, but they've also then made very disparaging remarks about many of the oral submissions made to Parliament, so that it makes it unclear. It is not clear blue water, as you put it. It's kind of like somewhere in between, and I don't fully know. So if I'm voting on that issue, I can't vote DA.
Well, I mean, this is it's exactly what Ramon described earlier has happened to the DA on this. So when land expropriation without compensation first was articulated as an issue, in other words, it was adopted at the ANC's conference, and then more particularly in Parliament, the EFF-motivated motion was adopted by the ANC and the EFF, it was very easy for the DA to say, and I think it was very good initially, to say exactly where it stood, because it could merge the EFF and the ANC's position, and it could say, under no circumstances can you nationalize all land. We're fundamentally against this. It will destroy the economy. It was actually, I wrote an article, I think, for Report, saying this was great for the DA. It's the first time it's had an issue where it can, in a long time, where it can stand up and say blank and white.
Post-Zuma.
Yeah.
Importantly, yeah.
And but what's happened since then is that the two positions have disaggregated somewhat. The ANC is allowed, as it always does brilliantly, a whole lot of processes to unfold and determine the sort of public sentiment and position, which is now all over the place. And the DA is sort of caught in this ambiguous mess, waiting for some kind of hard position so that it can take a counter position. And it differs from organizations like AfriForum and the EFF, which are like, we know exactly where we stand on this kind of thing. We've got a clear issue, and we don't care what these public processes or anything say. This is our bottom line.
Mm.
And, yeah, so this attitude of waiting for the ANC to say something before you can say something costs the DNA's kind of debate.
Is it perhaps a problem, when you say it's a problem of leadership, is it perhaps a problem of understanding that a political party can be democratic? Well, obviously it's democratically elected, but as an internal policy, it should not be democratic. Does the DA have a problem with that, in terms of there's too many people, too many cooks cooking the broth, so to speak?
Yeah, look, I think for the last 3 or 4 years, I don't actually know how some positions have been determined in the DA. I think they're sort of done by a committee, depending what's in the newspapers in the morning. And then they're not properly disseminated through the party, so someone else will take a different position.
Yeah.
It's all a consequence of being reactive, not proactive.
Yeah.
If you're proactive, you get to set the agenda, you get to bring everyone on board, and you get to push a line that people know where they stand in relation to it. If you're reactive, because you're a giant organization, different people are going to say different things, different committees are going to decide different positions, and you have this kind of all over the place.
I mean, ideal world, you can't always do this, but the daily goings on, whatever gets published in the newspaper today should be irrelevant a lot of the time, unless it's a bombshell, to your party, because you understand what your guiding principles are. You've made certain decisions on, be it the economy, be it health, be it tax, whatever decisions you've made. So the day-to-day goings on should make very little difference. If something comes out in the paper that the health minister wants to push a certain policy. It shouldn't matter whether that happens one week and another week there's some other story about a different health policy. Your answer should be generally the same, because as a party you should know exactly where you stand on providing healthcare.
Yeah, it's a 5-year cycle between elections. I mean, that's what you should focus on, the 5 years, not the minutia.
Yes, well, all day-to-day political communication should be informed by a strategy, a long-term strategy, which is something is very hard to discern from the DA. I'm not sure if they have one formally, I mean, written on paper, a sort of formal strategy or not, but you work backwards from the strategy. So there are things that happen on a day-to-day basis that you do need to respond to for the record or as a matter of principle. But I agree in that you should use day-to-day communications to promote your strategy. And so actually most of the things that happen in the media should be hooks for you to, you know, illustrate or drive pre-existing positions that are of strategic importance to the party. And as I say, you can't do that all the time. There are things you need to respond to that are important on a day-to-day basis. But for the most part, your strategy should inform your communications.
Yeah, it's about reiteration of policies. So they've done ANC, done DA, EFF. Well, I think they just lie back and watch, you know, shit go down, so to speak. I see that there were some, I was away, so I saw there were like gunshots fired at something near the Vol, which is, I mean, these internal conflicts tend to happen in these very autocratic political parties. Mm-hmm. But I think Malema has everyone by the hair, so to speak, and they just paddling along. They're not gaining terribly much support, but I don't think they want don't want much support. They're very happy to be the intransigent minority party that will dictate, you know, the policy of a far greater, more powerful entity like the ANC.
Do you think that's true, or do you buy the Julius ultimately wants to go back to the ANC and he's going to be the kingmaker with his 6-8% when the ANC drops below their majority?
Yeah, look, well, that's the big question with regards to the EFF, is what their long-term strategy is. And I think the party, and I don't want to suggest that they're different factions. This is just my impression of the way in which it behaves, is somewhat confused about its long-term goal. Its problems are this, is that if you position yourself, which the EFF is now doing, consciously and deliberately in the media, as the sort of radical conscience of the ANC, then you've got a problem, because if the ANC does grow or manages to stay a certain size without you, your role becomes redundant in effect. You're sort of neutralized at the election. So you can have claimed to have done all these kind of things, but it didn't result in any support and no one actually voted for you. And then you've got a massive identity crisis because your very thing that you have positioned yourself as resulted in no votes. And I think Malema and other people in the party are doing sums about what the long-term point of this organization is. If it is to actually bring about a revolution and, you know, if a socialist utopia and all its various goals, then it needs to be able to grow as a political party, and it's struggling to do that at the moment. At least the by-elections post-Zuma suggest that it's struggling to do this in a big way. There are areas in which it's growing, but there doesn't seem to be any fundamental breakthrough. It's not like it's going to come out of 20% in this election by any stretch of the imagination. And that's a real problem for your message and who you are and what your purpose is and why you exist. So I'm not sure what the solution is. I mean, this election in 2019 is going to answer a lot of big questions for a lot of political parties. I mean, it's key for Ramaphosa to get a mandate that is hopefully not in the 50s as far as the ANC is concerned. I mean, he'll want to get 60% and above. It's key for the EFF because it needs to be able to show that all the bluster and shouting and radicalism has resulted in some actual support. Otherwise, it's all been for nothing. And it's absolutely key for the DA because this is the first national test of a new leader, and the party's been floundering for the last 6 months. So this is a big election coming up.
Yeah. I mean, I just – on the EFF thing, you know, since 2009, I've sort of said that the only thing I've ever believed Julius when he said – because he lies all the time and he's now being mocked quite rightfully as being a flip-flop. But – The only thing I've truly believed that he said is that he will die an ANC member. He will forever be an ANC member, and he will live and die as one. And I just think if you're being smart politically, what you do is you go, all right, well, the ANC is on a downward trend generally. At some point, they drop below the 50% mark. What allows me to re-infiltrate, become a cabinet minister, or become a member of the top six? Well, if I'm able to give them the power back when they drop to 48%, then that will probably propel me into that position. I could do the same thing now. I could cynically say, well, who is being left behind by the ANC, by the DA? Maybe it's the black middle class. So maybe I could cynically start a party that only appeals to the black middle class. I talk about issues that matter to them, and I only try to capture their vote. And, well, they're about 6-7 million people, but let's say a good 20% of them vote. That probably puts me with, I think it would be 20-odd seats in Parliament. I could very cynically do that and go, well, at some point the DA might take power, the ANC might drop, but the DA will need power with a coalition, which what's his name with talking about coalitions?
Leon Schreiber.
And I could say, well, that'll position me perfectly. I don't need to join the DA now because I'm going to fight a whole bunch of DA. I've got to go to this stupid school to start off with. But other than that, I've got to fight a whole bunch of structures to get my way up to the top. Maybe I'll do it this way. And I really believe that's the Julius plan. I'm not sure their identity crisis matters, because even if they can just hold 8%, I think that's their strategy.
Look, I agree with you. I mean, I think Malema has always wanted to return to the ANC. And if you look at the kind of things he said when he was expelled, you'd be an ANC member for life. You know, his blood is black and gold and all sorts of colors, not red. And he's, you know, we're going to return to the ANC, and he's going to lead the ANC one day. I absolutely agree that I think that is something he wants to do and something he wants to use the EFF with. But this is a problem that all, you know, one-person parties find out.
Yeah.
You start a political party and it takes on a life of its own. And there are a lot of people that are invested in this organization now that are not necessarily of Julius Malema's position or share his particular history and fallout with the ANC. They legitimately want a platform for radical socialism. They don't believe that the DA is the ANC is redeemable in any kind of, you know, revolutionary way, and have invested a lot in this party. And you need to bring everyone on board with you if you're going to go back into the ANC. And the longer a political party exists, the harder it is to do that.
Yeah, I'm just looking forward to the day Malema has a proper opposition in the EFF who wants to take control. Like, if you can have two camps, I want to see how he manages that. If there's a proper challenger to the throne, I think they'll end in bullets. As these things tend to happen in these, like, you know, hardcore authoritarian parties, it'll be quite fun to see.
I think, it has already happened to smaller extents. There was, not long after they started, there was a challenge. I forget the guy's name.
Andile.
No, there was another guy. But Andile was, there was one from Andile, but there was another guy involved. And I'm told that at branch level, in the EFF, you do not speak ill of dear leader, otherwise you are quickly dispensed with. And that's not in a murderous sense just yet, but certainly in a political sense, you are gotten rid of.
But you wrote a very interesting piece about the EFF, I think it must have been last year by now, where you look at the turnover rate of MPs and people in the legislatures across the country. And you said it's very high. I believe you said it was close to 60%, something to that effect?
60%, in Parliament for the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. So basically, you know, 60% of the EFF caucus is different to what it was when it was first elected in 2014. And I must actually update that document because I think it's had some even further new MPs since then. But it's linked to what Jonathan was talking about. I mean, this absolutely authoritarian code of conduct, which if you read it for the EFF, there are about 8 or 9 clauses for which any person inside the EFF can be found to either be colluding with another party, bringing the name into disrepute, not, you know, implementing the EFF's radical agenda satisfactorily to dismiss people. And so it is almost impossible, I would imagine, to express a view that is critical of the leader or the leadership or the party, internally or externally, that doesn't violate one of these, which gives the leadership this massive authority to be able to dismiss people on any grounds at once, really, who are problematic or critical of the party.
Can I ask why? You know, this is interesting to me because I think most people don't know that about the EFF and the internal workings of the party. But when the DA has a vote on how they're going to change their rules and it results in Patricia de Lille being ousted, for example, it's national news and the EFF uses it against them. And not one person in the DA turns around and goes, hold on a second. Like, we're the German police, but you're the frickin' SS. Like, shut up.
Yes. The EFF has not, it has a lot of the characteristics of a authoritarian party. It's actually very successfully implemented. Internal discipline, it's brutal on the sort of one message, one step, one hand clap attitude to the way in which it communicates. It does very successfully. Malema has all the characteristics of a kind of charismatic, dictator. One of them are these internal documents, which are actually mirror the ANC's. I mean, front and center is democratic centralism, this idea that there's so much that Malema's taken wholesale out of the ANC. One of them is this idea, which is this Leninist idea that, you know, we disagree internally, a majority wins out on the day, and then everyone gets into line.
Yeah.
And there's no external idea that there was any disagreement. Once that internal decision has been made by a majority, that is everyone's position. And, it brutally implements that kind of thing. It's very effective at it.
So onto a few happier things. the ANC quotes Twitter account. Becoming one of my favorites.
Yeah.
How on earth? Okay.
And opposition quotes.
Yeah, well, that's the new one. But for those who don't know, so basically you just take quotes from ANC members going back,
it goes back about 20 years, I think.
There's no time cap.
Time cap. How on earth do you remember these quotes or research them? Because I remember reading them like, oh, yes, I remember that from like 2008. And you completely forget. You know, she did say that stupid thing. Like, how do you know which quotes are the most ridiculous? Because it's difficult to find the more ridiculous quotes of the ANC because there have been hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Well, it's a benefit of my occupation. You know, I mean, I was 11 sort of years in the DA as an opposition researcher, so you build up massive databases of what the ruling party said and the alliance members and so on and so forth. And I mean, because I've carried on writing, over the 5 or 6 years since about politics, my primary concern, I've kept all that stuff up. So it just occurred to me, I was just looking at my laptop one day, that I have these gazillion quotes on my laptop, which many of which are totally wacko and mad. And some of the others are quite serious, and some of them are very good from a kind of hypocrisy point of view. They make perfect sense at the time, but are now rendered completely mad by the way the party's acting today. And so I just asked, the Twitter whether they thought they'd like an account, and people seemed to think it was a good idea, and it's done pretty well since then, yeah.
And do you pick themes of the day, or do you just obviously you have to sort of react to the news of the day and see what quote will fit, or do you just take like the most ridiculous ones and like, here you go, public, this is what they used to say and still say?
No, most of them are, I sort of will do like a big cull at the beginning of the week and have sort of 60 in my drafts on my phone and then just release them over the course of a week. But if something does happen, if an issue does break, like the fuel price or the recession or something like that, it is quite easy to try to find ones that work from a contradictory or hypocritical point of view and put those out quite quickly. But basically, it's just, I just take a chunk off my laptop and then release them slowly.
Yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying the accounts. The hypocrisy is quite interesting. Do you think that a lot of that is just driven by politicians say what the right thing is to say at the time, and then when it's sort of when things change, they just change. They go with the wind wherever it goes. Or did we at some point have, for example, an ANC who was truly against fuel price hikes and taxing the hell out of fuel for their own benefit?
I think there are different categories of these kind of hypocritical things. One of them are one of the most legitimate, in other words, the most excusable from my point of view, is when a party legitimately changes its view. Evidence changes, and as with any good intellectual, the facts change, the party adopts a different position, which is fundamentally, and that's fine. I mean, it might be funny to look at the two extremes, but that's understandable. Then there's the kind of expediency type of hypocrisy in which, and this usually happens on an individual, not a party basis. So you'll be caught out by something that is difficult to explain, and you'll just adopt a position in an interview in order to be able to appease the questioner or try to be favorable to the market. And then lo and behold, it's not actually what your party's position was. But then there are the more fundamental kinds of hypocrisy, which I think you're alluding to over the fuel price. Whereas if you look at the stuff that the ANC said in opposition from 1990 through to about 1994, well, through to the election, there are a whole range of issues in which it was almost entirely comparable with the way in which the DA behaves today and the positions it takes. On the side of the public, backing, you know, moral outrage on things like that and the fuel price hike. And no holds, you know, colors to the mast. This thing is inexcusable. You're behaving appallingly, and we absolutely condemn this thing, only to categorically change when it got into government. I have a little bit of sympathy in that all opposition parties learn life's more difficult when you're in government and not outside, but a lot of these positions are not things to do with the kind of constraints of power. They're actually to do with ideology, and yeah, it's switched on some really big stuff without explanation. Actually, that's the key point. Yeah. The problem is, if you take a different position, you need to explain how you – it's my problem with floor crosses. You know, I don't mind people legitimately and authentically changing their worldview and saying this party is not for me anymore. I want to go to another party. They need to explain to the public how you've changed from being a nationalist to being a liberal, or from being a liberal to being a fascist, or whatever it is that your switch is. You can't just say, I now support the ANC. It's just not good enough for me.
Well, I was about to lose my job in the DA, so I went to the ANC, yes. And I quite like this 2 million rand a year.
Yes.
It does me well.
Well, then there were two DA MPs in PE who just changed over last week. There
yeah, councillors.
Councillors, that's
yeah.
right.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that quickly since you brought it up.
So, Nelson Mandela Bay, so there's a coup. Athol Trollope says it's illegitimate because they weren't the right numbers. And a few, I think three at the end of the day, DA councillors switched over. One originally for yes. the vote and two subsequently. I can't see this being a good thing for anyone, if I'm really honest, because the new mayor is a UDM guy who is disliked extensively by everyone, and already, you know, 10 days after the fact, Treasury sends a letter saying, oh, there's already irregularities in the way you're looking at finances and tenders of the municipality. So, okay, maybe it's just to massage Julius's ego, because he says Trollope will go, and it's been a long-standing position that he will take out one DA mayor to show that he's powerful, and he picks the white one, of course, because he's a racist. But sixth time lucky. I can't see how this helps anyone at this particular time.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see the way in which that plays out in the polls, and I don't know the answer to it, because they're competing problems. So on the one hand, I would agree with you. People hate this kind of internal infighting and messiness. It drives up voter apathy. They can't distinguish who's right or wrong, and sort of a pox on all their houses. On the other hand, another very strong practical reality in power in South Africa is that power matters, especially to ANC voters. And this idea of being in control, being, you know, the predetermined force that's going to govern forever, plays very well, and they now have power and they can use it to extract money and tenders and all the kind of things that they do and facilitate patronage, and that all has an effect. On the other hand, it's been very good for the DA, because what this whole debate has done, and I would have said it was less good if it was just Nelson Mandela Bay, but the fact that it happened in Tshwane as well means that the DA has had huge amounts of publicity for its service delivery record, and to play it off against the ANC, and it's got the perfect kind of contradiction in Nelson Mandela Bay, where there's a book literally about how this party stole the city that it can juxtapose against its service delivery record. So
yeah, my sense of it is, you're probably about 9 months away from an election, give or take. Now you take over power. So if the DA hasn't done much in your area, by the time you come around to voting and you think the DA was quite poor, you're not blaming the DA because the guys in power aren't the DA, right? And even if they wanted to do a great job, which I don't think they do, but even if they wanted to, I think 9 months is quite a short period of time. So they let the DA off the hook for their failings. And so when it comes around to vote the next time, people might actually, who weren't going to vote for the DA, might say, well, actually, these ANC, EFF guys have been, UDM, have been in power now and things are no better. So let's go back to, I'm happy to give the DA my vote. It just seems like it lets the DA off the hook. And if the DA were doing a good job in your area, well, either they have to continue doing that, which that doesn't seem to be what their plan is. They want access to the funds. So that then will reinforce entrenched DA voters already. Surely come the next election, this backfires and the EFF basically loses that control. Because it was close. That was the closest metro. The DA was very close to taking it and having it outright and not having to ask any questions.
Yeah, look, the one thing you have to be careful about is a lot of the analysis of by-elections and local government, shenanigans matters less when it comes to national elections. South African voters behave a bit differently at national level. It might manifest more on the provincial ballot. But nationally, when it comes to a national election, this, you have to have done something really profound, of which this might qualify. I'm not writing it off, the sort of, to and froing of the government of Nelson Mandela Bay. People tend to vote for other stuff when it comes to national elections. And the overarching power of sort of party identities tends to play a far bigger role in determining people's choices. So I think the real impact will be in the next local government elections. I'm not sure whether you'll see a profound – well, it's almost impossible to actually tell because it's hard to track back to what the cause is.
That'll be 2021.
Yeah, I'm not sure. They're usually about 2 years or a year after the national election. So we'll see. I don't know if it's going to manifest in any fundamental voter change in behavior in the Eastern Cape. Maybe it will on the provincial ballots. I'm not sure.
Do you think there's any use of the DA – being in not a coalition, because I refuse to say that word, a partnership with the EFF in the other metros, because they're so different at a national level, and they're attacking each other at a national level on core issues.
Yeah.
Yet they're still somehow working in Joburg for some reason, maybe because Huma Mashaba appeases them a bit too much for my liking. But they try to take Son Simanga out, who we'll talk about in a moment. But is it worthwhile keeping these coalitions together for the DA for the moment?
Well, I think it is, yes. It's a difficult choice, and you could probably argue it's not just as forcefully. The key thing about coalitions, though, is consistency. You need to have a very clear idea internally of why you're doing this coalition. You need to explain that to your voters, and then you need to stick by that. Simultaneously, you have to have a very clear idea of what your bottom line is and at what point you will walk away. And voters need to understand those two things. They need to understand we're in a coalition for this reason, and if this red line is crossed, we're out of a coalition. And the EFF is making that very difficult for the DA. It's playing off different metros against each other. It's got complete double standards in the two different metros as to why it's behaving the way it is. Maya Mani's approach and the DA's approach seems to be we need to try and make these coalitions work no matter what. And I get that because I think no matter what, it is better than what an ANC government would deliver, particularly with the EFF as a minor sort of only voting informally on the budget and the election of the mayor, not actually having a say in the way in which governments are structured, and certainly not having its hands on the treasury or the finance portfolios. So I get that. And I think the DA is right to stand by it, and I think it's good for the party to be able to demonstrate what it can do in practical terms. I think the other thing that the EFF and the ANC realize because of what happened in Cape Town is that if you are able to run a stable government and deliver for 5 years, very hard for the opposition to get its foot back in the door, especially the ANC, which is totally useless at opposition politics. I mean, it doesn't have the faintest idea how to be an opposition party, what to do, how to behave, how to drive an agenda, how to communicate, what issues to do. It's just not in its universe at all. And so it's in its interest to permanently disrupt these coalitions, because if the DA gets that kind of foot in the door, a five-year, reasonably stable, delivering coalition, it's going to have profound implications on the votes in those areas.
Interesting. Okay, so it might be worthwhile, even though the EFF tries to take you out at each turn. So speaking of Tshwane, the mayor of Tshwane is now the candidate for the Gauteng premiership. And you, I think your tweet was quite accurate. Like, this just shows, like, the, what is the true word, the dearth or the glut? I can never remember, the dearth, the lack of leadership in the DA, where they have to just, you know, position people in power to other positions of power. That just shows that there's a lack of leadership within that structure already.
Yeah, I think there is authentically a lack of leadership depth inside the party, and so it is forced to do things like, you know, get a mayor to re-stand as a premier only 2 years into his term as a mayor, which is problematic for the city. And they might have done an assessment that they're not going to win Gauteng and it doesn't matter. But I do think that authentically, if you look across the country, there's a real problem with leadership, and at national level as well. There are some, you know, there's a handful of very good MPs at national level with a lot of status and experience and skill. But out of a caucus of 100, they're very few, and there doesn't seem to be any natural. It's actually quite healthy to have an alternate, I don't want to use the word faction because people automatically think that's going to war, but alternative group view inside a political party. Normally that amalgamates around an individual who's seen as the leader of that group, but it's quite healthy to have that kind of competition. The DA has it at the moment, this sort of internal conflict between, I don't know, liberals and I don't know what the other group.
Social Democrats is probably the polite term that they would call themselves.
Black Caucus. That's run by the three white men.
I don't think the stuff's cutting across.
Remind you of being a troll.
It's true.
Demographics.
The Black Caucus is like James Self and two other chaps. Supposedly. Not that it exists anywhere except in the minds of the media, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't look. Between these sort of two views as to which way the party would go, but they don't seem to have any real leaders. And Maimane himself seems to fluctuate between the two groups, so it's not like he always... Yeah.
Is it that they don't have lead? I mean, we had Caleb Kachalia in the studio, and it was a good podcast, and he said a lot of things that made me go, oh, okay.
He was principled.
Yeah, these are nice things to hear from someone that's from the DA.
Yeah.
So if it's true that they did an assessment and they aren't going to win anyway, and Khaled maybe is a little bit too strident for their like, he actually says, this is where I stand, and no, I'm not moving on that, which isn't the party I see at the moment coming from the DA. But what would be the problem with letting him win that race and be the face for Gauteng for the next elections? The thing is, you're saying that there's not a lot of leaders and there's not a lot of potential, and that is partly true. But at the same time, as when people put up their hands, unless they're, you know, it's like a high school, unless they're part of the in group, then it doesn't seem like they get given a shot.
Look, I can't explain that. I mean, I don't think there is a material difference between Khalib and Solly. I actually think Solly is pretty good for what he's done, and I think Khalib is pretty good, and they're both worthwhile candidates. I don't know why they wouldn't have chosen him.
It's not a criticism of Solly necessarily.
No, I totally get what you're saying. And, I mean, he was a mayoral candidate in 2016, so the party obviously backs him as being able to operate at that level. I don't see the downside. I don't know what the internal politics are that arrived at Solly, but I suspect it had a lot to do with him being black at the end of the day.
Ooh, ouch.
Yeah, I think
except
they want...
Caleb is black.
In the expanded definition.
Yeah, but I honestly think it boiled down to... Look, I don't demean Solly in any way. The guy's very good, and obviously he's run a great show.
Well, that's the whole problem with BE, isn't it?
But I think at the end of the day, the DA wanted a black mayoral candidate. for Shwani, and that was the fundamental primary, you know, motivating factor. Now, he might well have, this isn't to detract from his merit or skill, I don't want to suggest this is some kind of affirmative action appointment. It's just that the party would have nothing to have lost, I think, by having Ghalib. Mm. He might not have been a black mayoral candidate, but as you say, you know, he's not white, and he's very good. Would have extended their leadership capabilities and depth, because you learn being a leader in a formal position, and Sodi could carry on doing an excellent job in Shwani.
Exactly, and then he can take his turn next time with the track record.
Yeah.
That makes the most sense. But we just spent, okay, the best part of an hour talking about how, you know, politics actually won't save us in this country, Gareth. I mean, are you, I'm not despondent, because I sort of like the chaos. It's like something to fight for in a way. But, I mean, you who do this every day, you must be, A, very bored with politics, and B, are you sort of despondent? Like, are we not past the point of no return, so to speak, but there's just like nothing. There's no grand ideas, no grand visions. It's just the same crappy things every day.
I'm definitely quite depressed at the moment about the state of affairs. I mean, the every single issue that you think about, it's difficult to come up with any one alternative, one positive sort of counterexample that you can turn to. I mean, I was trying to think the other day of, is there any public institution that is working well and efficiently? And was a good idea? And, you know, I sort of came up with the Gautrain, which sort of works quite well. People seem to like it. It has people that seem like something that might qualify.
But it's a public-private partnership.
Okay, but whatever. I mean, you know, the government conceptualized it and implemented it, and it worked, and whatever it's structured, it seems to be something that works more than it doesn't. Outside of that, I was like, what? There's nothing. I mean, how is that possible that this many public institutions are just in a state of crisis? And, you know, we see the biggest icebergs or tips of the biggest icebergs in the public, you know, the nature of SARS or the PIC or whatever, ESCOM. There are about 1,000 SOEs out there. I mean, can you just imagine the state that these other institutions must be in? They're whole parts of the South African universe that we don't even look at. Like, the state of our museums and galleries are just beyond, I mean, they're totally underfunded, falling apart, in a real state of disrepair, and it's just, we don't have room to talk about this in South Africa, because there's just other stuff that's more important. But as an ordinary person, you experience this every day. You encounter all these smaller parts of the state that you don't, you know, encounter in the newspapers. You go to your local library, or you have an interaction at the local police station, and it's just, honestly, nothing seems to work, and it is profoundly enervating when it comes to, you know, enthusiasm for a better future, which is,
No, that's true. I mean, in my line of work, I have to go to courts and the Master's Office of the High Court, and a few months ago, I went there, it was closed, and so I asked around, and no, they haven't paid rent for 3 months, so the landlord kicked them out until they paid their rent. I was like, really? Yep. That's it. The Master of the High Court, the curator of all deceased estates, all trusts, all liquidations in Johannesburg and in Gauteng, didn't pay their rent on time.
Well, yeah, for 3 months.
I mean, more than half the municipalities don't even pay their electricity to ESCOM. They only get away with it because the ANC is in charge of the provincial administration. I mean, the first thing I remember the DA did in the Western Cape, one of the first things, was threaten to turn off the water when they first took over the city in Cape Town in 2006, was to threaten to turn off the water to the province because it hadn't paid its bills. And it could only get away with that because it had ANC people in the city.
Right.
And then
every year there's an audit, municipalities, 7% are like unqualified audits. You know, 7% of municipalities, yes, which amounts to like a dozen out of how many hundreds. There was, what other, I mean, even just last week, there was a building in Joburg, the Gauteng Department of Health building, just 20% fire, what do you call it, They just weren't compliant. Oh, yeah,
not compliant with regulations.
And three people died. Firefighters died.
Well, look, why are we trying to depress each other? I wrote a column a while ago about how big the numbers are. So, in fact, you can't actually get your head around it. If you look at, like, two of the big ones, take water and roads. So roads are managed by three different levels of government. They're national roads, provincial roads, and local government roads. And there's no consolidated figure. There's no department that actually takes the backlog, road infrastructure backlog, at national level, provincial level, and municipal level, which is the hardest to do because it's so complex and disparate, and comes up with a composite figure of this is what our road infrastructure backlog is. But you do get snippets of this kind of thing. So you'll hear, for example, that, you know, there's a 200 billion rand backlog for our national roads, which doesn't sound too bad, and that figure is about 2 or 3 years old, I think. Then Herman Mashaba will come and say, actually, we've got a 140 billion rand backlog just for Johannesburg roads. The Limpopo Roads Agency's backlog for just Limpopo roads is 160 billion. And you try to, I mean, I could only find about 10 or 12 of these figures, but you're over a trillion by the time you've got about 10 of them. And that's about 10% of all the figures that are out there. And by the time you put all these things together, the number is so astronomical that I don't think you can get your head around it. And what it basically means is it can never be addressed. It's too big. The debt on it grows exponentially. The roads decay at a rate that can't be kept up.
Unless you let the private sector deal with the roads, which might be the only way to solve our problem.
This private sector stuff. I mean, you take SAA, you'd have to. No one would buy SAA. It's
completely not now.
Bankrupt. Have to make it work before someone could buy it.
What you'd have to do if you wanted to take over SAA as a private entity, I would imagine, you would need to. Yeah. So the problem is that you would need to establish a new company called Airways South Africa instead of South African Airways or something like that, so that you didn't take on the debt, and then you'd have to transfer the routes. The problem is that I don't think it's that easy to transfer the routes. Because it's a whole new process, and only ownership of those routes, I think, is specific to SAA. And I think the problem now is the debt is so massive that, from what I understand from, you know, people who understand the airline business, it's not possible to turn SAA around.
The margins are razor thin anyway.
It's just too deep.
And to think, Gareth, to think that all this is about ANC control for literally patronage and funding purposes. There's no rational, reasonable reason why there should be 1,000 SOEs, or the government should control all the roads, or the government should control all electricity production in the country. Like, there is no logical reason other than self-interest.
I think you've got to be careful with that, because I think one of the problems that you have if you're of a particular worldview like I and you are, about the way in which you should structure the state and incorporate the private sector into making things work, is that you kind of assume that there's a disjuncture in logic. So we have a picture of the state that looks like this, and there are a whole lot of things that you could privatize. There are a whole lot of things you could work together with the private sector for. And it makes perfect sense. But I just don't think that the ANC sees it that way. They don't conceive of – it's not like they make a decision to go against logic. I think they conceive of all of these things as the state. And saying, let's, you know, sell part of SAA or whatever, to them is kind of like saying – you want to take this wall away from my house. It's like, why would you do that? It's not a house anymore. It makes no sense to me, you know. Whereas we don't see it as a house with walls that are connected. It's just a different view of it. And there's it's not like, why you're not going to out-logic them on this stuff. It just doesn't work like that. They have a different world view of how it's seen.
I'm not the government if I don't have a state airline, and I'm not the government if I'm not providing my citizens with electricity directly.
Yes, and there is obviously an ideological basis to all this kind of stuff. You know, it's like heavily influenced by socialism and a centralized state and kind of paternal role for the governing party, which is itself paternal in nature. But it sees this as an extension of itself, as one entity of which it has its claws in all the different parts.
Yeah, no, it's a religion. At the end of the day, that's exactly what it is. And I think, what do you think would happen if they admit that they failed? like at a fundamental level. Because they say sorry sometimes. Like now they blame, they used to blame apartheid, now they blame Zuma for the recession. But I mean, do you think.
And white monopoly capital.
Still. But do you think that there'll come a time where they'll say, listen, like we fucked up royally here. Because they know the stats about education. They know, you know, 60% of grade fours can't read or write.
I don't think
they know
ever,
all these things.
I don't think they can ever say they failed. And it doesn't work like that either, because the fundamental break for them is 1994 or 1990, whenever they, you know, were unbanned or defeated the apartheid state. And that is the point of comparison. And you would need a new point of comparison to be able to say that you failed in the way that, that you're suggesting. And I think that can only happen in retrospect after a crisis or a collapse, in which people inside the revolution or the movement are detached from it by a collapse or a crisis and are then in 5 or 10 years able to look back at it and go, we failed then. But in the moment, I don't think it's possible.
I tend to agree that in the sort of test ground for that is the Western Cape and Cape Town. I don't think the DA is at risk of losing that anytime soon. But I think as time passes, they will become at greater risk of losing it. And the reason is because when they took it back from the ANC, things were bad in that city and that province. Obviously, the city first and the province. But things were bad, but they were... There were cosmetic things. There was no great crisis. There was no water crisis, for example. There was no, you know, rights crisis like apartheid. There just wasn't a crisis. There was just decay. And the DA took a lot of that back, and certainly a lot of stuff works a lot better in Cape Town, for example, than it did before they took over. But I don't think people notice that stuff as much. And over time, their memory fades of, you know, stuff not working in Cape Town city centre, the economy not being particularly strong, companies not doing business there, etc., etc. And so I do think that, that over time that, that becomes a big problem and a threat is, you know, for the DA, for example, of the ANC rising back up and going, but look at all these problems the DA has. And the DA will go, but remember when the ANC was in charge? And people go, no, actually we don't. It wasn't that bad.
There's an important point to make on this, which follows on from what Jonathan's saying, which is that, you know, one of the fundamental problems with these administrations that the DA takes over, the metros and stuff, is that they inherit a huge amount of debt. Most of them, and in fact, Nelson Mandela Bay was on the brink of bankruptcy, and Shwane and Joburg had the same kind of problems. And this, a lot of that goes to revenue collection. But as a resident, just before I get into that, obviously you want to collect rates so that you can fund your economic program, the vast majority of which, whoever is in government, goes to, you know, alleviating things like water. You get rebates on electricity and funding service delivery for those kind of things to impoverished areas. Inability to collect rates means you can't provide those kind of things, but because the ANC is able to just rack up these kind of debts to fund its program of action, the person on the ground doesn't experience any different. The, you know, they get electricity, they get water, they get their rebates. They see, like, you know, a school or is being maintained or a house or something is being built. They don't understand that the people that are delivering this are about to run out of everything. Everything's going to switch off if you bankrupt yourself. And so the DA takes over, improves rate collection, you know, manages to fund all these kind of programs, but it's effectively for the person on the ground delivering the same thing that they were before. And it's very hard to illustrate to those people the fundamental difference and security that they now have.
No, that's very true. I haven't noticed a discernible difference in Joburg since Mashaba came over, except they really want money a lot quicker than before.
But I don't think you will for the first 5 years. I mean, you've just got to fix the way the system operates for the first 5 years. Before you can start to deliver meaningful stuff. I mean, it is a huge amount of work to turn around a metro administration.
So without you being a prophet necessarily, Gareth, next year's election, I foresee status quo mostly. ANC high 50s, low 60s, DA stagnant, EFF maybe 7-8%. Cope maybe like 0.5% more than what they got before, but I don't see great turbulence in well, the election
two,
results?
Two things on that. The one is, yeah, I would say that at the moment the ANC is in a band from about 58 to 62, and I'd say that's roughly its maximum and minimum for the election, depending on how it goes, because these things fluctuate on current affairs. I'd say the DA is between 22 and 24. Depending on how things go, it's a much more fragile percentage range for the DA, and it does fluctuate quite wildly depending on current events. But I would say, yeah, pretty much stagnant, or it could get up to about 24, and I'd say the EF sort of 6 to 8%, maybe 9 if it has a really good day at the office. But the exciting thing is that we've got a poll in the field for the IRR, which we should get soon. Which I'm really quite excited about, which will hopefully give us some idea specifically of where the EFF is. And it's also going to go into issues of land and favorability and Ramaphosa and Ram enthusiasm or all the stuff. So, yeah, that'll be interesting to see.
So we can talk about this every single day, you know, 24 hours a day, and yet ANC still wins. And we think they're idiots.
Yeah, well, it's okay. People at one point will just have to choose, you know, get people to hold their place in the bread line as they go to the voting line to cast their vote for the ANC. So that's fine. All's well that ends well, hey?
Well, I won't be here. I'm going to the Republic of Cape Town when it secedes. It will have to de facto secede.
It will never happen. Just like the SAA will never leave the government and Eskom won't. It's the same wall in my house. The Western Cape is a part of the house and you they will not allow it.
The Western Cape
to
is a beautiful pot plant.
Dude, you've got a government in the Western Cape that's anti-gun and you want to secede against a government that has shown they will use maximum force against their populace. The Western Cape is not seceding anytime soon. No one in South Africa has balls for anything like that. It's not going to happen. At least the Spanish blow shit up.
On that thing.
Yeah, the Cape Party, they were
in. Cape Party, the most violent they'll do is
deface
art. I mean, really. Let's get real. The reality is, if you really want to secede, then you need to be willing to go all the way. And I'm yet to find many South Africans who are willing to go all the way.
You're on the wrong WhatsApp groups.
Well, clearly.
Get off the clearly. I Love Melville groups about moaning about dog shit in the streets and come to the real ones, the revolutionary radical ones.
All right.
Ones.
Thank you, Ramon. Thank you, Gareth. Much appreciated. We can find you on Twitter, multiple accounts. You want to just pump them quickly?
Yeah, it's my account's at Chief and Onslin, and then these two quotes accounts are at Quotes ANC and at Opposition Quotes.
Awesome.
And you can read your work in Business Day.
Yeah, I got a column in the Business Day, and then we put out longer term stuff from the Institute, which you can get on the Institute's Twitter account.
Awesome. So as always, you can find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Report, on Facebook, the page, and the group. Thank you so much for listening. I hope your week is better and less shouty than Serena Williams. Enjoy. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.